Picture this. You are sitting in your living room in Vancouver, Washington, and you're holding, I don't know, roughly $500,000 in home equity. And you are seriously considering a move that sounds, well, on paper, it sounds completely financially reckless.
Yeah, totally reckless.
Right. Because you're contemplating spending $160,000 more to buy a substantially smaller house, and it's 4 hours north.
Which is wild.
It is wild. You are giving up the ultimate Pacific Northwest life hack, which is that tax-free shopping just across the river in Oregon. And you're actively signing up for a winter that is statistically darker and more overcast than the one you already complain about.
Yeah, that's the kicker.
So why are you doing this? Why are you, the listener, looking at this 250-mile trek up the I-5 corridor to Bellingham? Well, it's because you are desperate to escape gravity.
Right. And specifically, you know, the inescapable heavy gravity of the Portland metropolitan orbit. I mean, that is the true catalyst here.
Yeah.
You aren't chasing a financial windfall, right? And you certainly aren't fleeing the state. You are basically engaging in a highly specific, geographically contained interstate migration just to buy back your psychological bandwidth.
And to help you navigate this extremely specific journey, we're pulling apart a fascinating piece of intelligence today. We've got our hands on a comprehensive hyperlocal relocation guide and cost breakdown.
Yeah, this thing is incredibly detailed.
It really is. It was published in early 2026 by a Whatcom County real estate broker. And I mean, this isn't some generic top 10 places to retire listicle, right?
No, not at all.
This broker specializes almost exclusively in this exact Vancouver to Bellingham pipeline. So he sees the bank statements, he feels the anxious phone calls, he knows exactly where the dream of ocean views basically collides with the brutal reality of a Seattle traffic jam.
He really sees the whole picture.
He does. So our mission for this deep dive is to tear down the glossy marketing facade. We're going to look at the real, unflinching math of this equity transfer. We'll look at the honest truth about the climate trade-offs and the massive logistical friction of trying to buy $500,000 worth of real estate through a smartphone screen.
And, you know, the overarching theme that emerges from this broker's data is, well, it's fundamentally counterintuitive to how we normally discuss real estate migration.
How so?
Well, usually when we see a massive influx of buyers moving from a larger market to a smaller one, say, like the classic San Francisco to Boise route or New York to the Carolinas, it's a story of financial arbitrage.
Right. They cash out.
Exactly. People are cashing out. They're moving to a lower cost of living area, buying a mansion for cash and, you know, putting $1 million in the bank.
But the Vancouver to Bellingham buyer is doing the exact opposite. I mean, they're moving to a smaller city, a regional outpost, really, and paying a massive premium for the privilege.
Right. Which sounds crazy.
It does. From a pure math perspective, this sounds like a terrible deal. So how does a broker look a client in the eye and justify this transaction when they see these numbers?
Well, he justifies it because the buyer isn't coming to him for financial advice. They are coming to him for an exit strategy. The guide paints this picture of a demographic that is just, they're simply exhausted.
Exhausted by the commute, mostly.
The commute, but also the whole dynamic. To understand the numbers, you have to really understand the sociology of a satellite city. I mean, Vancouver, Washington has historically occupied a very strange liminal space.
Right. It's huge, but it doesn't feel independent.
Exactly. It's a city of nearly 200,000 people, but its identity, its economy, its cultural rhythm, and its daily traffic patterns have always been entirely dictated by Portland, Oregon, sitting just across the Columbia River.
I want to dig into the mechanics of that relationship because the broker refers to this as the heavy orbit. It isn't just that Vancouver is close to Portland. It's that Vancouver is absorbing the pain points of a major metropolitan area without reaping the structural benefits.
Right. It's a classic municipal imbalance. Over the past 5 to 10 years, Portland has faced some incredibly well-documented systemic challenges. We are talking about chronic homelessness, a severe housing affordability crisis, spikes in property crime, and a protracted struggle to maintain the vitality of its downtown core.
And that just bleeds over.
Exactly. Those pressures act like a fluid, right? They don't stop at the state line. They spill north over the bridges right into Clark County.
So, okay, let's unpack this. If you live in Vancouver, are you essentially paying the Portland premium in stress without actually getting the benefits of living in Portland?
Precisely. Vancouver residents are seeing the visible encampments. They're feeling the ambient anxiety of rising property crime. But because they're in a different state under a different tax structure and in a different municipal jurisdiction, they have zero control over the policies driving these issues.
And zero access to the massive commercial tax base that a city like Portland uses to try and fund solutions. Vancouver is shouldering the overspill of urban decay. But, you know, when a resident wants to go to a world-class art museum or fly direct to Tokyo or eat at a Michelin-caliber restaurant, they still have to cross that river and pay into Portland's ecosystem.
Yeah, you bear the psychological costs of the city without keeping the cultural dividends at home. What's fascinating here is how the lack of a distinct, independent civic center basically pushes people to seek a self-contained town.
Which brings us to the physical manifestation of that satellite status, the commute, the Interstate 5 corridor. The Broker's Guide is incredibly bleak on this point.
It really is.
It zeroes in on the stretch from Salmon Creek in North Vancouver down to Portland's Fremont Bridge. On a standard Tuesday morning, going southbound, that drive is taking 60 to 90 minutes.
And we really need to pause and look at the physiology of that. 60 to 90 minutes of stop-and-go gridlock is not just lost time. It is a daily prolonged injection of cortisol.
Oh, absolutely.
You are trapped in a metal box, hypervigilant, constantly hitting the bikes, navigating aggressive lane changes. You arrive at work already depleted, and you arrive home in the evening carrying that residual road rage right into your family life.
I always picture it as a massive, cruel funnel. I mean, you have hundreds of thousands of people waking up in suburban Clark County, getting into their cars, and the geography forces them to pour into this incredibly narrow, choked-off choke point over the Columbia River.
Right. There are only two primary bridges.
Yes, a total infrastructural bottleneck.
And the data suggests it is a bottleneck with no near-term relief. The guide actually cites 2045 regional planning projections indicating that without sweeping multi-billion dollar infrastructure changes, this commute time is expected to double.
Wait, double? Are you telling me a bad 90-minute commute becomes a 3-hour commute? One way.
That is the trajectory. And we have to look at the mechanics of why it isn't being fixed. The Interstate Bridge Replacement Project is notorious in urban planning circles for its glacial pace.
Because it involves two states.
Exactly. You have two different states, Washington and Oregon, with different funding mechanisms, different political priorities, and massive environmental review hurdles regarding the Columbia River ecosystem. The current bridge is functionally obsolete and seismically vulnerable, but the political gridlock over how to replace it.
Like whether to include light rail or tolls.
Right. Whether to include light rail, how high the clearance needs to be for river traffic, how to toll it. It means there is no cavalry coming over the hill to save the commuter anytime soon.
And the pressure isn't just on the roads. The Broker notes that the internal infrastructure of Clark County is buckling under aggressive population growth. We are talking about persistent budget cuts and labor tensions in the local school districts.
Yeah, it's the compounding effect of rapid residential development vastly outpacing civic infrastructure. Developers build thousands of new single-family homes and apartment complexes, but the roads, the fire stations, the parks, and the schools simply cannot scale at the same speed because municipal funding lags behind. So you have a community that feels like it is bursting at the seams, lacking an independent, cohesive center to anchor it.
When you lay all of that out, the traffic, the spillover crime, the stressed schools, the constant shadow of a larger neighbor, the psychological appeal of Bellingham suddenly makes total sense. I mean, the Broker describes taking a phone call from a Vancouver resident in July.
Oh, the sailboat story.
Yeah. He talks about looking out his window at Squalicum Harbor, seeing people out on sailboats, Mount Baker rising up in the distance, and the defining characteristic of it all. Bellingham is a city of roughly 98,000 people. And it is nobody's satellite.
It is fiercely self-contained. Bellingham is anchored by the bay, the mountains, and Western Washington University. It has its own economy, its own distinct culture, its own downtown core.
It's independent.
Varies. Your daily mood, your traffic patterns, your safety, they are not dictated by a larger metropolis 14 miles away. That self-containment is the emotional product the Broker is actually selling.
But the moment you, the listener, decide you want to buy that product, you run headfirst into a brick wall of financial reality. Let's look at the concept of financial thermodynamics here. Energy, or in this case, wealth, isn't being created by this move. It is just changing states. And you are going to bleed a lot of efficiency in the transfer.
Yeah, the hard numbers from early 2026 are stark. According to regional reporting cited in the guide, the median single-family home price in Vancouver, Washington, sits at $549,000.
And the median in Bellingham for that exact same period is $710,000.
That is an 18% premium, an extra $161,000 just to hit the median benchmark of a smaller town.
So walk me through the mechanics of how a buyer actually pulls this off. Because if I'm holding a $549,000 asset in Vancouver, I don't magically have $710,000 to spend. The broker provides a very specific equity example in the text, and I want to break down exactly how this transaction works behind the scenes.
Okay, let's run the exact scenario. You list your median Vancouver home for $549,000. Before you even think about buying in Bellingham, you have to account for the friction of selling. The broker estimates 5 to 6% in total selling costs.
Let's unpack that 5 to 6% for the listener, because that isn't just a random number. What is eating that equity?
It's a combination of mechanisms. First, you have real estate agent commissions, which, despite industry shifts, still typically consume a significant percentage of the gross sale price. Then you have title insurance, escrow fees, and crucially, Washington State's real estate excise tax, or REIT.
How does the excise tax work? Because that's a silent killer of equity.
Well, Washington uses a tiered system. As of the recent structural changes, you pay a certain percentage on the first $500,000 of the sale price and a higher percentage on the amount above that. Yeah, and when you combine the state rate with the local municipal REIT rate in Vancouver, it takes a healthy bite out of your proceeds at the closing table. So after all these transactional frictions, your $549,000 gross sale turns into roughly $521,000 of actual liquid net equity in your bank account.
Okay, so I am sitting in Vancouver with $521,000 in cash. I drive 4 hours north. How far does that money actually go?
If your goal is to keep your monthly mortgage payment exactly the same as it was in Vancouver, you have a major constraint. You take 20% of your new purchase price from that equity to avoid private mortgage insurance. The broker's math shows that if you use $104,000 as a down payment, you can target a home price around $520,000 in Bellingham.
Hold on. You just told me the median in Bellingham to $710,000. So what on earth does $520,000 buy me? I'm assuming I'm not getting the idyllic water view in the massive yard.
You are absolutely not getting the water view. At $520,000 in early 2026, you are buying significantly below the median. You are looking at a smaller footprint, likely an older home requiring cosmetic updates, or you are looking at neighborhoods further away from the historic downtown core places like the outer edges of the Barclay neighborhood or the more dense suburban pockets.
So it's a downgrade.
Yeah. You have successfully preserved your wealth and you haven't increased your monthly burn rate, but you have fundamentally downgraded your physical housing standard.
What if I refuse to downgrade? What if I am moving to Bellingham specifically for that Pacific Northwest lifestyle dream? The Craftsman House, the tree-lined streets, maybe a peak of the bay.
Then you transition to the second scenario. You stretch your budget to, say, $649,000. You put your 20% down, which is roughly $130,000. You take the remaining $391,000 of your Vancouver equity and apply it to reduce the total loan amount.
But I'm still taking out a significantly larger mortgage than I had in Vancouver.
Precisely. You are absorbing heavier debt to acquire an equivalent physical asset in a more desirable, albeit smaller, market. You are reallocating your capital away from other potential investments, like your retirement accounts or your children's college funds, and locking it entirely into your housing overhead.
Wow.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, you're paying a 15-20% housing premium solely for lifestyle, not financial arbitrage.
Here's where it gets really interesting. We are talking about spending an extra $100,000 just to be in a town of 98,000 people. Is the listener just trading financial stress for a prettier view? I mean, is there any financial relief on the back end? Do day-to-day living costs drop dramatically once you get to Bellingham to offset this mortgage penalty?
The guide is brutally clear on this, no. The broker meticulously outlines what he calls the wash costs. And it turns out living in the Pacific Northwest cost basin is remarkably standardized.
Let's audit those day-to-day costs, income tax.
It's an interstate move. Both cities are in Washington state, so you still enjoy a 0% state income tax.
Sales tax.
Nearly identical. The guide notes the city of Vancouver's combined state and local sales tax rate. It's roughly 8.9%. Bellingham sits right next door at 8.8%.
What about the grocery store? Does a gallon of milk cost less when you aren't adjacent to Portland?
It does not. Mm-hmm. The broker points out that both regional distribution networks fall under the same broader Pacific Northwest pricing tier. Groceries in both markets consistently track about 5 to 8% above the national average.
Right.
A cart of groceries at the Bellingham Fred Meyer costs exactly what it costs at the Vancouver Fred Meyer. Same with a gallon of regular unleaded gas. It tracks the same statewide averages, heavily influenced by Washington's specific carbon pricing and gas taxes.
The Costco test. The guide actually mentions this. If you walk into a Costco in Clark County and you walk into the Costco in Bellingham, your physical reality is identical. The pallets of paper towels, the rotisserie chickens, the pricing is indistinguishable.
Yeah, exactly the same.
So the day-to-day feels the same. But the underlying mortgage math is tighter. The engine of your life, the mortgage drafting out of your checking account on the first of the month, is revving much harder.
There are, however, a few micro differences the guide highlights that we should dissect. Some work in your favor and some actively work against you. On the positive side, property taxes are actually slightly more favorable in Whatcom County.
Wait, why is that? If the houses are more expensive, shouldn't the taxes be universally higher?
It comes down to how local levy rates are structured against assessed values. Property tax in Washington is budget-based. The county determines how much money it needs to operate and then divides that total required revenue by the total assessed value of all property in the district to arrive at a levy rate.
Oh, I see.
Clark County's effective rate runs between 0.90 and 0.99%. Bellingham's effective rate is lower, hovering around 0.85%.
So on a $650,000 house, what are we actually saving?
You're paying roughly $5,525 a year in Bellingham. It's marginally less than the tax burden on a similarly priced but physically larger asset in Vancouver. But whatever small victory you win on property tax, you instantly lose on utilities.
Explain the utility dynamic, because the source specifically calls this out as a friction point.
In Vancouver, you are served by Clark Public Utilities, or Clark PUD. This is a public utility district. It operates on a not-for-profit basis, governed by locally elected commissioners, and it has access to relatively cheap, abundant hydroelectric power from the Bonneville Power Administration.
Oh, right, the hydropower.
Exactly. Consequently, Vancouver utility bills are notably lower than the national average.
Yeah, in Bellingham.
In Bellingham, you switch to Puget Sound Energy, or PSE. PSE is an investor-owned utility. While heavily regulated by the State Utilities Commission, it operates under a fundamentally different financial model than a public PD. The broker warns that clients moving from Vancouver often experience sticker shock when their winter heating bills arrive from PSE.
And that leads perfectly to the largest invisible financial penalty of this move. The broker is incredibly astute to point this out. If you move to Bellingham, you permanently surrender the ultimate Vancouver cheat code, the Oregon tax loophole.
The cross-border shopping dynamic.
It's massive. If you live in Vancouver and you need a $3,000 OLED television, a new MacBook, or you're outfitting your entire house with new kitchen appliances, you do not buy them in Washington.
Yep.
You drive 10 minutes over the I-5 bridge into Portland, Oregon, where there is 0% sales tax. You load the items into your truck and you drive home. You are legally saving almost 9% on every major capital purchase for your household.
And the broker refers to losing this as a real, if modest, psychological blow. When you live in Bellingham, the nearest zero sales tax state is hundreds of miles away. You are paying that 8.8% on the television, the laptop, the refrigerator. It adds hundreds, sometimes thousands of dollars to your annual baseline spending.
Let me summarize this financial picture because it is sobering. The listener is paying a $160,000 housing premium. They are taking on heavier debt. They are paying more for their winter heating, and they have lost their tax-free shopping haven. The math is incredibly defensive. So we have to ask, what on earth is the return on investment here?
According to the source, the return on investment is atmospheric. You are buying a completely different relationship with summer, but to get it, you have to survive the psychological endurance test of a Bellingham winter.
This is perhaps the most crucial section of the broker's guide. He calls it the honest climate trade-offs, and the honesty is brutal. He literally writes in the prospectus, "I'm not going to sell you on the sun here, because this is not a sun story."
It is a remarkable piece of anti-marketing, but it's essential for expectation management. Geographically, both Vancouver and Bellingham share the baseline traits of a maritime Pacific Northwest climate.
Which means, broadly speaking, wet, gray, and damp from October through April.
Yes, the fundamental character is the same. The raw temperature data for winter is virtually indistinguishable. January lows in both cities hover right around 34 to 35 degrees Fahrenheit. Both cities will occasionally deal with a rogue snowstorm or a freezing rain event that shuts the city down for 3 days because neither municipality has the snow clearing infrastructure of a place like Chicago.
But the mechanics of the precipitation of the cloud cover are where the divergence happens. The guide notes that Vancouver actually receives more total rainfall, about 42 inches annually, compared to Bellingham's 36 inches.
But volume of water is not the same as volume of gloom, and this is a critical meteorological distinction. Bellingham receives less total inches of rain, but it experiences a significantly higher number of overcast, heavily gray days. The source cites roughly 230 completely cloudy days annually for Whatcom County.
How does that work mechanically? Why is it less wet but more gray?
It has to do with Bellingham's specific placement on the Salish Sea, tucked between the coastal islands and the Cascade foothills. The marine layer, this thick blanket of low-level stratus clouds, pushes in from the Strait of Juan de Fuca and simply gets trapped against the mountains.
Ah, I see.
In Vancouver, storm systems tend to blow through, you know. You might get a torrential downpour in the morning, followed by sunbreaks in the afternoon. In Bellingham, the storm might just be a persistent misty drizzle, but the ceiling of gray clouds will sit a few hundred feet above your roof for 3 consecutive weeks without breaking.
The ceiling feels lower. It feels oppressive.
It is deeply oppressive, and the broker is so acutely aware of this psychological weight that he subjects all his prospective out-of-town buyers to what he calls the November test.
Explain the November test, because this feels like a rite of passage.
The broker actively discourages clients from doing their initial scouting trip in July. He tells them, do not come when the water is sparkling. Come in mid-November. He wants them to arrive when the mountains are completely socked in by clouds, when it has been drizzling for 10 days straight, and most importantly, he wants them to experience the reality of the latitude. Bellingham is significantly further north than Vancouver.
The guide specifically highlights the phrase, the light is low by 4 p.m.
Exactly. By 4.15 p.m. in late November, you have to turn on the headlights in your car. By 5.0 p.m., it is pitch black. You are waking up in the dark to go to work, and you are driving home in the dark.
That's rough.
It is. The broker forces his clients to stand in a potential driveway at 4:30 p.m. on a rainy Tuesday in November and ask themselves, can I maintain my mental health in this environment for 5 months straight?
It's brilliant, honestly. Because if you buy a house based on a visit in July, it is the equivalent of buying a used car because you like the color of the paint without ever turning the key in the ignition to see if the engine knocks. I mean, it sounds like buying a car based on how the air conditioning feels without ever taking it on the highway.
That's a perfect analogy.
You are buying a fantasy. If you survive the November test, you are buying reality.
But we have to look at why anyone would subject themselves to the November test in the first place. And the answer lies in what has happened to the Vancouver summer.
This is the flip side of the coin. The guide details how the climate in Clark County has fundamentally shifted over the past decade. It's no longer just a mild, sunny reward for surviving the winter. It has become dangerous.
The data the source uses is terrifying. While Vancouver's historical average July highs are listed at 77 to 81 degrees, the region is now highly susceptible to stagnant atmospheric blocking patterns.
Heat domes. The guide specifically references the catastrophic event of 2021. The Portland-Vancouver metro area reached 116 degrees Fahrenheit.
And let's discuss the mechanics of 116 degrees in a region where historical architecture was never designed for extreme heat. Most older homes in the Pacific Northwest don't have central air conditioning, right? They were built to retain heat, not expel it.
Right, exactly.
At 116 degrees, the ambient temperature radiating off the asphalt at midnight is still in the high 80s. You cannot open your windows to cool the house.
And it isn't just the heat, it's the air quality.
Exactly. The geographic curse of the Columbia River Gorge. During late summer, as wildfires burn in eastern Washington, Oregon, and California, the shifting wind patterns frequently funnel that thick, toxic smoke directly down the gorge, pooling it in the Portland-Vancouver Basin.
I remember reading about this. The air quality index hits 400. You have an impenetrable layer of smoke trapping 100 degrees of heat beneath it. You're essentially living inside a convection oven, running portable AC units 24/7, taping your windows shut, and you can't let your kids play outside for 2 weeks. It's an apocalyptic, traumatic experience.
Now, compare that to the summer data the broker provides for Bellingham.
it looks like a completely different planet. Bellingham's average July high is 72 degrees.
72 degrees, and it is mechanically protected from the heat domes because it sits right on the cold waters of Bellingham Bay and is buffered by the San Juan Islands and the Strait of Georgia. It has an immense maritime cooling engine right on its doorstep. When Vancouver is suffocating under 105 degrees, Bellingham might creep up to 82.
The broker describes this visceral, physical relief of a Bellingham August. You don't have an air conditioner. You just open the windows facing the bay at 8 p.m. The sea breeze pulls the cool air through the house, and you sleep under a blanket.
It raises a profound question for you, the listener, regarding lifestyle constraints. What kind of weather actually keeps you indoors? Are you more psychologically damaged by a 45-degree drizzly Tuesday in November, or are you more physically endangered by a 105-degree smoke-filled Thursday in August?
That is the ultimate trade-off. You are buying a cool, clean summer, but you are paying for it with 230 days of gray. And speaking of winter, the guide notes that your relationship with winter recreation is going to change drastically. A lot of people in Vancouver ski. Mount Hood is right there.
And the transition from Mount Hood to Mount Baker is a massive culture shock. The source does a fantastic job of contrasting these two distinct mountain cultures.
Break that down for me. How different can two ski mountains in the same region really be?
Fundamentally different business models and topologies. Mount Hood, serving the massive Portland market, is highly developed. You have multiple large resorts, Timberline, Mount Hood Meadows, Ski Bowl. You have massive historic lodges, extensive high-speed lift networks, groomed boulevards, and a very robust après-ski culture. It is built for volume, comfort, and families.
And Mount Baker.
The guide uses the word raw to describe Mount Baker. Baker is legendary in the global skiing community, but not for its amenities. It holds the world record for the most recorded snowfall in a single season, over 11,140 inches. It is situated closer to the ocean, so it catches the absolute brunt of Pacific storm systems.
The facilities.
Spartan. There are no massive luxury hotels at the base. The access road is notoriously steep and rugged. The lift infrastructure is older. The culture is deeply rooted in backcountry access, avalanche awareness, and steep ungroomed terrain.
Sounds intense.
It is. The broker warns that if you are a casual Mount Hood skier who enjoys taking a few leisurely runs on corduroy snow and then drinking a hot toddy by a massive fireplace at 2 p.m., Mount Baker is going to be incredibly intimidating. It is a mountain for purists who want deep powder and zero frills.
Okay, so let's say the listener is a purist. They've passed the November test, they are ready for the Baker powder, they accept the 230 days of gray, and they've made peace with the $160,000 equity hit. The next massive hurdle, and honestly the one that derails most moves, is the physical logistics of keeping your life together. Can you actually sever the cord from Portland?
We have to look at the logistical reality of travel, career maintenance, and civic integration.
Let's start with travel, because the broker is bombarded with questions about this. A client will ask, well, I can still just pop down to Portland for my monthly client meeting or to see my parents for Sunday dinner.
Right.
And the broker's answer in the guide is a definitive, unvarnished no, not conveniently.
Because everyone looks at Google Maps and says, oh, Bellingham to Portland, it says 4 hours and 10 minutes.
Which is a purely theoretical calculation based on driving 70 miles per hour at 3 in the morning. Let's trace that route on a normal weekday. You leave Bellingham, and within 90 minutes, you hit the northern edge of the Seattle metro sprawl at Everett. From Everett, through downtown Seattle, past SeaTac Airport, through Tacoma, and past Joint Base Lewis-McChord. That is roughly 80 miles of some of the most unpredictable, densely congested interstate in the country.
If a single semi-truck blows a tire in Fife, your four-hour trip is instantly a six-hour trip.
Exactly. The friction of that drive is immense. You cannot treat Portland as an adjacent city anymore. It requires a dedicated, exhausting weekend trip.
Wait, if the listener has family in Vancouver or clients in Portland, are they essentially moving out of state in terms of travel time? I mean, you can't just pop down for Sunday dinner anymore. But wait, I'm a modern professional. I'll just fly. I live in Vancouver. I'm used to PDX. I'll just fly out of Bellingham down to Portland.
You won't, because you can't. The aviation data in the guide is a harsh reality check. There are zero direct commercial flights from Bellingham International Airport, BLI, to Portland International Airport.
Why? That makes no sense. They're two major Northwest cities. Why wouldn't Alaska Airlines just fly a little puddle jumper between them?
It comes down to the brutal economics of modern regional aviation. The industry has shifted heavily away from point-to-point regional service between smaller hubs, especially in the wake of pilot shortages and consolidated route networks. Airlines utilize a hub-and-spoke model. For Alaska Airlines, Seattle-Tacoma is the massive centralized hub.
So to fly from Bellingham to Portland,
you have to fly the spoke to the hub. You drive to the Bellingham airport, go through TSA, wait, fly 35 minutes to Seattle, disembark, wait out a layover, board a new plane, and fly 40 minutes to Portland. By the time you factor in the door-to-door transit, the guide calculates a minimum of 4 hours. Alternatively, you drive 90 minutes south from Bellingham, park at SeaTac, and fly direct from there.
You are losing the magic of PDX. If you live in Vancouver, PDX is 10 minutes away. It has over 50 nonstop destinations. It's renowned for its efficiency, its local food vendors, its lack of stress. You are transitioning from an international hub lifestyle to a regional outpost lifestyle.
The broker notes that clients who underestimate this specific friction point often experience deep buyer's remorse in their first year. If your identity, your extended family, or your professional obligations are deeply tied to the Portland metro area, you are functionally moving out of state.
But maybe that is the secret genius of the move. If it takes 6 hours of grinding traffic or a convoluted flight connection to get back to Portland, you stop going. The friction enforces the boundary you were looking for in the first place. You are trapped in your new town, which forces you to actually live in it.
That is precisely the sociology of integration. You stop outsourcing your entertainment to a larger city, and you start walking 12 minutes to the local coffee shop on Railroad Avenue. The friction of travel becomes a feature, not a bug, enforcing a slower, more localized life. But you can only afford to live that highly localized life if your income isn't tied to the local economy.
Right. Let's talk about the job market, because Bellingham is not a corporate powerhouse.
The guide is incredibly transparent here. The professional corporate job market in Whatcom County is remarkably thin. The economic anchors are Western Washington University, the regional healthcare system, specifically Peace Health, some advanced manufacturing, and a robust small business service sector. If you are a mid-level corporate director looking to climb a ladder with multiple competing Fortune 500 companies, Bellingham cannot support your career arc.
So how are all these people affording $710,000 houses?
The broker calls it the great equalizer, remote work. The vast majority of the Clark County transplants executing this migration in 2026 are fully or at least 80% remote.
They are decoupling their income source from their geographic location. They earn a Seattle or Portland or San Francisco salary, but they deploy it in Bellingham.
Exactly. If you have secured a permanent remote position, the local job market limitations become irrelevant. You utilize Bellingham purely for its lifestyle dividends while extracting capital from a larger digital economy.
Okay, so the job is secure via a fiber optic cable. The next critical piece of logistics for the typical buyer profile outlined in the guide is schools. The source breaks down the Whatcom County educational landscape into three distinct options.
And these options align closely with specific demographic preferences. First, you have the Bellingham Public School District, which serves the city proper.
How does the presence of a university alter a local school district? Because the guide makes a huge point of this.
It creates a specific gravitational pull. Western Washington University's College of Education provides a steady pipeline of student teachers and innovative pedagogical research directly into the local schools. Furthermore, university towns naturally attract a high density of faculty, researchers, and highly educated professionals who tend to enthusiastically support local tax levies to fund arts, music, and advanced STEM programs in the public schools.
That makes sense.
Yeah. The guide notes the test scores and graduation rates sit comfortably above the state average, and the district enjoys a degree of political stability that has been lacking in some Clark County districts.
But what if I want something a bit more traditionally suburban? The guide points to Ferndale, right?
Yes. Ferndale sits about 15 minutes north of downtown Bellingham. The broker positions this as the transition zone. It has more suburban density, newer construction traps that feel very similar to the developments in Vancouver, and a school district that is heavily invested in community athletics and modern facilities.
So it's a bit more familiar.
Exactly. It's for the buyer who wants to be close to the Bellingham amenities, but prefers a more traditional, perhaps slightly more politically mixed, suburban environment.
And then there is Linden, 25 minutes north.
Linden is a fascinating demographic case study. The guide highlights the Linden School District as consistently ranking among the top performing districts in Whatcom County regarding raw test scores and graduation metrics.
And the broker's guide maps out the civic culture of these areas as well. Now, just to be super clear to you, the listener, we are neutrally reporting the demographic data directly from the broker's guide here. We aren't taking any ideological stance or endorsing any political viewpoint. We just want to help you understand the regional variations mapped out in the source.
Right, absolutely. The guide categorizes Bellingham as leaning heavily progressive and center-left, driven directly by the university culture. But it paints Lyndon as having a fundamentally different character. The guide describes Lyndon as a traditionally conservative community, deeply rooted in a rich agricultural history and a very strong focus on community athletics. It is a much quieter, highly self-contained small town.
It's really fascinating how the broker uses these demographic profiles, not as political endorsements, but purely as matching tools to help his clients find their specific comfort zones. He notes that Clark County buyers, who are coming from a relatively politically mixed environment in Vancouver, usually find a pocket in Whatcom County that fits their worldview simply by moving 10 miles north or south.
So you have mapped out your career, your travel limits, and your school district. Now you face the final boss of this process. How do you actually buy the house?
This is where the logistics get wild. I mean, you are 250 miles away. You can't just casually hit up three open houses on a Sunday afternoon. It's a four-hour drive.
Which is why the broker has developed a highly formalized, almost militaristic, out-of-state buying playbook. And the first step is the triage phase, the discovery call.
I love how blunt he is about this. Sure. He forces you onto a 30-minute video call before you are allowed to drive up. He looks at your verified pre-approval amount, and then he looks at the neighborhood you think you want to live in.
And he breaks dreams. The guide states that nearly half of these initial calls end with the client realizing the math doesn't work. They want the historic charm of Fairhaven on a Barclay budget. He saves everyone 500 miles of driving by forcing financial reality on day one.
Let's actually look at those neighborhoods, because the guide breaks down the five primary targets for Vancouver transplants. Let's start with the crown jewel, Fairhaven.
Fairhaven is the historic district on the south side of Bellingham. It is characterized by late 19th century brick architecture, cobblestone accents, independent bookstores, high-end restaurants, and immediate walkable access to the waterfront trails. It feels like a self-contained, upscale village.
But the entry price is severe. The guide lists the starting point at $700,000, easily climbing well past $1.1 million. This is for the buyer who is willing to dramatically downsize their square footage in exchange for total walkability and historic aesthetics.
Next is South Hill, geographically adjacent to Fairhaven, but functionally different. The broker calls this the family stronghold.
Why is it a stronghold?
Because of the lot sizes and the elevation. As the hill rises up from Bellingham Bay, the streets become incredibly quiet, the lots get larger, and many homes secure sweeping panoramic views of the water. It offers excellent access to the local elementary schools. Prices range from $550,000 for a fixer-upper to over $800,000 for a modernized view home.
Then we have Edgemoor. This sounds like the hidden VIP section of the city.
Edgemoor is tucked away on the southwestern edge of the bay. It is defined by its mature, massive tree canopy, deep setbacks from the street, and a heavy concentration of mid-century modern architecture. It is supremely private. And from the higher elevations, you get unobstructed views of the San Juan Islands.
But the guide warns that inventory here is basically non-existent. People buy into Edgemoor and they never leave. When a house does hit the market in the $750,000 to $1.2 million range, it is fiercely competitive.
For a much more pragmatic, math-friendly approach, the guide points Vancouver buyers toward Barclay.
Barclay is where the numbers start to resemble Clark County. You are looking at $480,000 to $680,000.
Barclay is heavily favored by pragmatic buyers because of its infrastructure. It features newer construction, highly developed retail villages, including a massive movie theater and grocery complex. And critically, it offers immediate, easy access to Interstate 5. If you are doing that brutal SeaTac airport commute we discussed, living in Barclay shaves 20 minutes off your departure time compared to navigating out of Fairhaven.
Finally, the Columbia neighborhood.
Columbia is the urban core option. It sits just northwest of downtown, highly walkable to the city center, and relatively close to the university. It is dense, filled with historic craftsman homes on smaller lots, and has a very vibrant youthful energy. Prices range from $500,000 to $750,000.
So, you've narrowed down your neighborhood via the discovery call. You are set up on the Northwest Multiple Listing Service, the NWMLS. Let me stop and explain why that matters. The NWMLS is the centralized database that every real estate agent in Washington uses. If it's for sale, it's there. You get an alert on your phone the second a house is listed.
And because the Bellingham market moves so fast, you don't have time to drive up, which triggers the most anxiety-inducing step of the playbook, the virtual showing.
Buying a $700,000 house, based mostly on a video call, where a guy points out bad drainage, that requires a massive amount of trust, doesn't it? It sounds absolutely terrifying. You are asking me to evaluate a $500,000 asset through an iPhone lens.
It requires an immense amount of trust in your broker. The guide outlines how the broker physically goes to the property while you sit on your couch in Vancouver on a Tuesday afternoon. He initiates a FaceTime call. But the crucial differentiator is that he is not giving a sales pitch. He is performing a remote audit.
The examples in the text are great. He doesn't just show you the beautiful granite countertops. He actively searches for the flaws. He walks outside, points to the camera at a puddle in the backyard, and says, "Look at this grating. The water is pooling directly against the foundation. This yard drainage is a serious liability."
Or he holds the phone's microphone up to the bedroom window, stops talking, and lets you listen to the drone of the semi-trucks on the arterial road three blocks away. He provides the sensory friction that the marketing photos intentionally hide.
So you use these brutal virtual audits to aggressively slash your list. You look at four houses on FaceTime, you eliminate three of them. And that sets up the final maneuver, the strike weekend.
This is where being exactly 4 hours away is a unique geographic advantage. It's too far for casual browsing, but it is exactly within range for a highly targeted military-style deployment.
Picture this. You leave Vancouver on Friday night after work. You drive the 4 hours. You stay in a hotel. Saturday morning, the broker has blocked out four straight hours. You walk through the one or two houses that survived the FaceTime audit.
You spend the afternoon driving the specific neighborhood to understand the grocery store access, the school drop-off route, the general rhythm of the street. And by Sunday morning, you are sitting in a coffee shop writing a legally binding offer before driving back down I-5.
But making that offer brings up a massive financial puzzle. The guide tackles the dreaded home sale contingency. For the listener who hasn't bought real estate recently, explain what this contingency is and why the broker says it is the kiss of death in the Bellingham market.
A home sale contingency means you write into your contract, "I promise to buy your house in Bellingham for $700,000, but only if my current house in Vancouver successfully sells within the next 30 days.
So you are transferring all of your personal logistical risk onto the Bellingham seller.
Exactly. And in a highly competitive, low inventory market like Bellingham, sellers simply will not accept that risk. Why would they tie up their property waiting for a transaction 250 miles away to close when they have three other buyers offering cash or standard financing without that baggage?
So how do you get around it? If all my wealth is trapped in the Vancouver house, how do I make a clean offer?
The guide details the primary workaround. Utilizing a bridge loan or a ELOC, a home equity line of credit, on your Vancouver property before you list it.
Let's break down the mechanics of a bridge loan in a high-interest 2026 environment, because this is not free money.
A bridge loan is a short-term, high-interest loan that leverages the equity in your current unsold home to provide you with the cash needed for the down payment on the new home.
It's temporary liquidity.
Precisely. It allows you to walk into Bellingham and make a strong, non-contingent offer. You secure the new property. Then the immense pressure begins. You must immediately list your Vancouver home. When the Vancouver home sells, the proceeds instantly pay off that expensive bridge loan, and you are left with your standard mortgage on the Bellingham property.
But the risk? What happens if the Vancouver house doesn't sell in 30 days? What if the market shifts?
That is the terror of the bridge loan. If the Vancouver house sits, you are suddenly carrying the mortgage on the Vancouver house, the massive monthly payment on the high-interest bridge loan, and the new mortgage on the Bellingham house simultaneously. The financial burn rate is catastrophic. The broker warns that this strategy is highly effective, but it requires substantial financial reserves and an iron stomach.
Assuming you survive the financial gymnastics, the actual closing process is relatively smooth because it is an intrastate move.
Yes. You are operating under the same state laws. The escrow timeline conventions are identical. The guide mentions using local title companies like Chicago Title in Bellingham, who seamlessly coordinate remote closings. They overnight the final documents to a mobile notary in Vancouver. You sign them at your kitchen table and the fens are wired. You never have to drive back up north until the day you take the keys.
We have dissected a massive amount of intelligence from this relocation guide. We will pull all these threads together for you, the listener contemplating this move. The reality check is profound.
The narrative the data tells is undeniable. Moving from Vancouver to Bellingham is fundamentally a lateral financial move that demands a severe upfront housing premium. You are spending upwards of $160,000 more just to maintain your current housing standard.
You are accepting higher utility bills. You are permanently sacrificing your tax-free shopping trips across the bridge to Oregon.
You are accepting the logistical nightmare of flying out of SeaTac instead of PDX, fundamentally altering your travel convenience. You are tying your career survival to the persistence of remote work, given the lack of local corporate density.
And perhaps most daunting of all, you are signing a contract to endure 230 days of heavy, oppressive gray skies, passing the brutal November test where the sun vanishes before dinner.
But if you can absorb the financial premium, and if you can withstand the meteorological gloom, the dividends are life-altering.
You completely eradicate the soul-crushing 90-minute commute over the Interstate 5 bridge. You step out from beneath the immense heavy shadow of Portland's ongoing urban struggles.
You trade the terror of 116-degree heat domes and toxic wildfire smoke for a reliable, comfortable, open-window summer. You gain immediate access to world-class raw recreation in the San Juan Islands and on Mount Baker.
You buy your way out of a sprawling satellite suburb and buy your way into a fiercely independent, highly localized community.
You pay the premium to escape an orbit, and you finally find your own center of gravity.
Which leaves us with one final, incredibly provocative thought, a concept the broker briefly touches on when discussing the psychology of his clients 6 months after they move. He notes that once they settle in, they suddenly realize they have forgotten what it feels like to constantly be driving to somewhere else.
They experience the vacuum of time.
Exactly. Think about the mechanics of this. If you successfully execute this migration, you strip away the daily grinding friction of the commute. You strip away the ambient background stress of living on the edge of a struggling metropolis. You remove the constant need to cross a river for entertainment. Suddenly, a massive quiet vacuum opens up in your daily routine. And the ultimate question for you, the listener, is this: what do you actually do with that reclaimed time and mental space?
Are you genuinely prepared to face the reality of a quieter life? A life where your happiness, your stimulation, and your peace depend entirely on your immediate localized surroundings. A slow walk to a Glostor, an afternoon on the bay, a quiet street, rather than relying on the frantic energy, the noise, and the passive entertainment of a major city.
It's the ultimate psychological test of this entire endeavor. It's not just about mastering the brutal math of the real estate transaction or navigating the logistical friction of a bridge loan. It is about understanding the physics of your own mind. Once you are finally allowed to stand perfectly still, you aren't just escaping a heavy orbit. You have to learn how to breathe and how to thrive in a completely different atmosphere. Keep questioning the math. Keep exploring the possibilities, and we will catch you on the next deep dive.